listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Monica Melanchthon. And we have with us a guest, Dr. Gerald West, who is Professor Emeritus from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. He's a Hebrew Bible scholar, author, activist, Bible study leader, churchgoer, well, lots of things, lots of good things. And we are really very happy to have him here with us on this podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Gerald, for being here.
Yeah, Robin, Monica, thank you. It's lovely to be here with you. I'm delighted by the invitation.
Great. And we have a busy program today. It's Pentecost week 10, and we are going to attempt to discuss all four readings, beginning with Isaiah 5, 1 to 7, then moving on to the Psalm 80, Luke 12, 49 to 56, and Hebrews 11, 29 to 12, 2. So, over to you, Old Testament scholars, for Isaiah 5, 1 to 7. In a passage that starts a bit like a love song but goes horribly wrong, right? What do we need to know to unpack this imagery here of the vineyard and what's going on?
I think perhaps a good place to start is to try and divide the text into its different voices. And I think that's a useful thing to do as one reflects on these texts. And there's no right way of doing it, but it is a way of trying to make sense, particularly in a text like this, of the voices that we begin with and the voice we begin with and the voice we end with, and then the voice in the middle. And I think we've got three, there's an engagement between these voices. Mm.
And can you say more about who they might represent or whose voices or perspectives we're perhaps getting here?
So it seems that we begin with the voice of the prophet and speaks of the people. Mm-hmm. Then the prophet's voice is interrupted by the voice of God, right? And then once God has spoken, we then come back to the voice of the prophet.
Oh, that really helps.
Yeah. So it begins, as Robin already pointed out, you know, as a love song that goes kind of awry. Is that the right word? Yes. Yeah. towards the end. What is happening here, Gerald?
Well, it seems I'd like to emphasize the vine, the notion of the vine, which we also then find in the psalm. And so I think our lectionary readings connect. But it would seem here that the idea of what God has established has somehow become corrupted. It's become extractive rather than redemptive. And so the vine that should have nurtured the community has become a vine that no longer bears fruit. Mm-hmm. And God is recognizing that. And I think Isaiah wants us to see the economic dimensions of this. That there is exploitation, there is extractive economics, if you like, that the vine is no longer a place of plenty for the community, but for the few, and therefore God is going to remove this vine.
Yeah, the language at the end is quite striking in verse 7 of, you know, he expected justice but saw bloodshed. I mean, there's violence and injustice, right, in a place that should be, I mean, I think of vineyards as wonderful places. But
romantic places.
Yes, lovely to visit.
Yes.
So is there, how would you preach this text? What is there good news in here?
I think for me, what is important is the recognition of the fact that we, I don't know how many of us have experiences actually trying to grow grapes, but this was a metaphor that worked for the audience of that time. Being an agricultural community, I guess they didn't have to wrestle with their brains to determine what this meant. They knew exactly what the prophet was talking about. And so for those of us who do not belong to that context, we may, you know, take time to try and understand what is actually happening here and why this particular metaphor is being used. But what is, I think, the text is pushing for is the recognition of the fact that sometimes our efforts may not bear fruit, and that our efforts may be influenced by our own individual agendas.
Yes, yes.
And those agendas may not be ones that are necessarily helpful or of service to the community, but oneself. And so here this particular farmer went out to do what he thought was appropriate, did everything that was required, and yet the vineyard bore sour grapes. Mm. And so it's a time for when we need to actually reflect upon why did it fail? Mm. Where did I go wrong?
So it invites that kind of reflection personally and maybe in our communities as well.
Right. And as we say at home in South Africa, before you can hear the good news, you have to hear the bad news.
Yeah.
And I think this is about the bad news we need to acknowledge in ourselves and in our communities in order then to hear the good news of the gospel.
That's really helpful.
And I think another thing for me that stands out is the fact that, again, we haven't yet come to Psalm 80, but in Psalm 80 you have at least three different identities being ascribed to Yahweh. So God is first of all the shepherd, and then God is also the king, and God is the farmer. And in Isaiah, the main metaphor here of God is the one who tends to the vineyard. Maybe you wouldn't call him a farmer, but the similar imagery works with the land.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
No, I think the idea of God as a farmer is a lovely image.
Mm.
And I think this harkens back to a time when every family had its own vineyard.
Mm.
And gradually what happens with the centralization of ancient Israel is the monarchic state begins to dominate local vineyards and to use their resources to serve a few rather than to serve everyone.
So
God as the farmer who cares for everyone is I think a lovely image.
And I think if you want to apply it to today's context, most of us are not farmers necessarily.
Yeah. Although a lot of our listeners are in rural settings, right, so we may have some farmers listening.
And some of us, for myself, for example, I do not know how the economics works behind. Mm. But one of the things I learned growing up within sort of feminist circles is the fact that every little decision we make is a political decision or has political consequences. So as consumers, we have a role to play in terms of the choices we make, helping the agriculture or helping the economy, who we give preference to and who we don't in the choices we make. I think there's an element there where we can take responsibility for our choices.
And I know here in Australia, I was at a dinner not long ago with a farmer talking about how all the farms around him, he's in the Western District of Victoria, are being bought up by mass corporations because, in fact, the only way to make money now is with shared machinery. Yeah. Again, if we want to keep local farms, I mean, we're maybe straying a bit from the Bible reading, but there's some implications to think about in terms of justice and economics and the kind of communities we want to shape.
And I think it's Gandhi. Definitely Gandhi who said that there is actually enough food in the world if it is shared justly with everyone.
Yes.
And so starvation and the lack of food to certain sections of the community today is not because there is no food. It's just been improperly distributed.
And healthy food, of course, in this economy, and I think this is a global thing happening with inflation, healthy food is becoming exorbitantly expensive. And so we get, on effects, struggling for language, the ongoing effects of that on health and other things for people who are poor in our communities and can't afford access.
Yeah.
But we should turn to the psalm.
Yeah.
How does this image, is there something different that the psalm adds or that we should be attentive to, particularly if we're going to maybe preach these texts together?
Again, look, the psalm uses the image of the vine. I think it does a little differently.
Yeah.
I mean, what's interesting is the psalm is a kind of a retelling of the Exodus story, but now not using the people as the metaphor, but the vine as the metaphor. But it is the same. It's the same image of the vine that is no longer productive, that is being allowed to deteriorate. Verse 12, why have you broken down its hedges so that all who pass the way pick its fruit? This is something that no longer has care. It's not being farmed in an appropriate kind of way.
Yes, and it's not being guarded from the boar of the forest and other images in here.
Yeah, and the people, the speaking voice here is the community, you know, the community is lamenting, saying, God, you're the one who is the farmer,
you know,
and as I said earlier, the shepherd and the king and now the farmer, and you are responsible for our care. And why is it that we are experiencing what we are experiencing now, you know, this catastrophe? And so therefore the psalmist who is speaking or the community is questioning God asking why and for how long this is going to continue, but at the same time saying, we are still dependent on you, therefore listen to our cry and let your face shine. And you know, that phrase appears about three times in the psalm, and let your face shine is something indicative of, you know, please be present in our lives, don't let go.
That we may be saved is the follow-up line there at the end. I mean, that's a lovely refrain to even use liturgically and in prayer, right? I mean, as we bring our own questions and demands and struggles to God in the liturgy.
Yeah. But the richness in the psalm also lies in these various images of God. God as farmer, God as king, God as shepherd. And there is a sense of stewardship and responsibility that comes with people who hold those positions.
Yes.
You know, either for the earth or for creation, for humanity. And so I think there's a message here for people in positions of leadership.
Right.
Yeah.
In terms of what is expected of them, in a way they need to be conscious of their own motives and their agendas and the impact that this has on the communities they are called to serve.
I think what's lovely about the psalm too is it's a reminder that lament is a part of our Christian tradition.
Yes.
You know, so much, particularly in Africa, so much of Christian faith has turned to this hyper-positive, you can't say anything negative, you can't lament because it shows a lack of faith. But there's a strong tradition in Scripture of crying out to God. So it's not a turning away from God with your questions, it's turning to God with questions. And there's no easy answer in this psalm, but the turning to God in questioning God, interrogating God, in lament, and even protest here to some extent, I think is a profound recognition of a key dimension of our faith.
Yeah, it's an act of faith. And we perhaps don't tell people that enough. Because like you say, people think if you're questioning God, if you're interrogating God, it is somehow about doubt. But I think if we turn to God even with our harshest of questions, that is about our relationship and faith in God.
And I think it's also important to recognize that God is not a saving machine that you can switch on and off. In a sense, this God is someone you have to cry out to call attention to. You have to call God's attention to your cry. And therefore, the psalm begins with those, you know, with those few lines about, calling on God, saying, come, save us, make your face shine upon us in verse 3. And so crying out to God is part of the tradition of the psalmist, of the Hebrew culture, and it is something that we need to also embrace as a way of approaching God.
So we might turn now to our gospel, which is Luke chapter 12, verses 49 to 56. And I know a lot of preachers sort of default to the gospel. This might be one of the weeks that people rethink that decision. Although don't shirk the challenge, perhaps, of preaching these difficult texts. I want to give this a little bit of context. We've got to remember we've been journeying with Luke 12 here, and we did have last week this image of Jesus coming like a thief, which I think you, Monica, pointed out is actually a very, it's a scary and, you know, it's a negative image, so we have had this sort of eschatological expectation mounting in this part of Luke about the unexpected nature of Jesus' turn, and then just prior to this, a conversation about masters and slaves, and again, the slave being ready. So we're sort of in the midst of a lot of expectation and maybe even a frustration on Jesus' part about people not being ready and not getting it and not quite being on board with his message. What do you two make, I don't know who wants to go first, of these, you know, difficult images of fire and stress, taking peace, bringing division? What do we do with this hard word?
If I may go first, I think for me what stands out is the fact that Jesus is leading a movement. Mm-hmm. It's a movement, and it's a movement of resistance. It's a movement of struggle. It's a movement against established powers and systems, you know, to reform the religion, the culture, the economy of the country at that particular time. And these, so a movement of that nature is prone to divide. And I think what first of all the text I think highlights for me the divisions that exist in the church in the world today, the polarization between on the basis of issues, but you can see this happening even within families. You know, if you take the issue of sexuality or divorce or adoption or you name it, families have been polarized. So why should this text be disturbing? It is actually a reflection of the reality of the world in which we live. But I'll stop here, Gerald.
No, Monica, thank you. I think that's superb. And this text has been very powerful in the South African context.
Okay.
Because one of the challenges, for example, of white South Africans like myself was you had to betray your own ancestral heritage. You had to betray your own mother and father, quite literally.
Yes.
In order to take a stand against racial segregation, against apartheid. For what God was doing in the country. And this text was a classic text for us because it articulated the choices we had to make every single day, as Monica was saying. And then the last few verses, 54, 55, and 56, is a summons to be constantly ready to recognize what God is doing.
Yes.
You know, God's at work, and if we want to work with God, alongside God, then we have to be attentive to what God is doing. You can't be complacent. You can't look after your own interests, which is what was happening in white South Africa. White South Africa was looking after its own interests and was not recognizing what God was doing.
Yeah. And I think, Gerald, in what you've said has highlighted for me, I think we so often, particularly in comfortable middle-class churches, we are so familiar with thinking Christianity is, it's got a culture of niceness around it. It's about harmony and, you know, being kind to one another. And yet here is a mandate for saying when matters of justice like racism are at stake, we might say the same for sexism and, you know,
homophobia
and other that actually harmony is not possible.
No, it's not.
To do the right thing or to follow where God is leading, there may be division and that will be difficult, but that is actually part of the work of God.
Yes.
It's a tense line, right? Because I don't want to be advocating for just go out there and create conflict. No. It's not.
But conflict is also an opportunity for doing something creative, to transform and to bring about something new. And so I think when we are dealing with these life issues, oftentimes conflict is inevitable.
Yeah.
But we should not be discouraged by it, but rather see how we can use that to fuel new thoughts, new visions, etc.
Yes.
Yeah. And we see that, I mean, we'll get there in a minute, in the Hebrews reading, where part of putting your faith in action is actually to suffer and face enormous conflict, sometimes at the cost of your own life.
That's
the level of conflict some early Christians at this and throughout history in various parts of the world still face.
Yeah. And I think what is important also in the Hebrews text is that irrespective of who you are, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, you know, son of a prostitute, doesn't matter. You have all been placed, you have all been given a role, and, you know, you use that in order to bring about good within the community.
Before we leave Luke, I want to just think a little bit more about interpreting this present time. I mean, there's something also very prophetic about that idea, right? That the, you know, it's about reading the signs of the times, not in a predictive way, but yeah. actually in a revelatory way, a kind of a revealing what God is doing and what we're doing that might be right. corrupt or, right. you know, it goes back to that examination I think you were talking about earlier, Gerald. How do we preach that? I mean, how do we ground that? I mean, the example you've given of the South African context, I think examples are helpful.
Yeah. What we've taken from this is a sort of a, if you like, a methodology or spirituality, which we have taken from the Catholic worker priest movement of see, judge, act. And this text, I think, is a great, so you see, what is God doing? You look at reality. Is God's kingdom come on earth? Is this what God wants? You look at reality. If not, you turn to scripture to judge this reality against God's prophetic word for our world. And if the world is not what God wants it to be, you act. And that see, judge, act should become a kind of a spirituality that we practice every single day. And the attentiveness to starting that cycle again, that we never stop the see, judge, act, see, judge, act, see, judge, act. Although a colleague of mine in Brazil says, see, judge, act, every time, every now and again, celebrate. When there's a moment of redemption.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's a lovely way to build into congregational life a process of see, judge, act.
Yeah. For me, what's also significant is the motif of fire and the refining element of our task of fire. And so in a way, the text is encouraging the community or the church to actually be open to this process of refining oneself, you know, to the dictates of the gospel or so basically, you know, be open to being changed, to being transformed, to being shaved off all the impurities in your life or all the blinders that block you from seeing reality as it is or your own participation in systems of oppression, etc. So we need to be refined as well.
Yes.
And I find it astonishing in sort of contemporary political discourse that one of the values seems to be that people are unchanged, that, you know, they've held a consistent line for their whole life. Yes. And yet the Christian, you know, the gospel story is so much about that refining you're talking about, Monica, that if we're not constantly examining ourselves spiritually, prepared to change our behavior, change our ideas about God as we learn more from the scriptures. I mean, then we're not growing in faith.
Yeah, and that is because reality is not stagnant or it changes, it's dynamic. And so every day there'll be a new challenge, a new stimuli that we need to address. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
And so that is, I think, what this refining process is about.
Yes.
Great. So lastly, our letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11, verses 29 to 12:2. And we started this sort of passage last week. We've gone through Abraham, and the lectionary didn't have Noah and Enoch and Moses, but we've had these great famous figures of faith, and now we have a cluster of people of faith, almost as if the author thought, I don't have time to tell all of these stories, so I'm just going to start naming a bunch of people and things. And I should say scholars have twisted themselves in knots trying to quite work out who made the list and why and what's referring to whom. But we should note, as you said, Monica, there are women on the list, there are Gentiles on the list, so the great exemplars of faith are not just the patriarch men in the tradition.
And not just Israelites.
So we've got an expansiveness here, even though the letter to the Hebrews feels very grounded in Judaism and in other ways in the image. What did you two notice here in this reading? What struck you?
Gerald?
Well, I wanted to come to the end, this very common notion of a cloud of witnesses. Again, this is a very African concept of the ancestors who go before us and who enable us to be a community. And again, one of the challenges for a white South African was to be adopted, if you like, by black ancestors. And that's the challenge here, you see. We are being asked to take on ancestors that are not biologically our ancestors. And so this is a nice link with the Luke passage, that sometimes we have to break in order to be redemptive. We have to break with our biological heritage and find other places to locate ourselves. And this is a summons, I think, to take on witnesses, not all of whom we can fully understand, but witnesses who represent something different for us to locate ourselves within.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to shout yay for all these Old Testament characters, because because most people think they have nothing to say to us today, but here they are witnessing to something quite beautiful. But in response to what Gerald just said, I think there's a challenge for those of us who live in Australia and how we might actually relate to the Indigenous culture and the Aboriginal community. And it, I think it's a huge ask, you know, and a difficult one too, to think about aligning ourselves with the Aboriginal community as sisters and brothers, recognizing them as sisters or ancestors, you know, and breaking the biological. I think that's a massive challenge, Gerald. Thank you.
Yeah. And you've reminded me of, I mean, even in the Gospels, and it's not in our particular lectionary reading, but I think it's relevant. I mean, Jesus is asked about his family, and there's division in his own biological family. And he says, who are my sisters and brothers? And they're the people who follow and hear his voice. So there's a reforming of family, which is not easy, right? Back to the division. In claiming the ancestors and seeing ourselves in this story of which, you know, we're a part of as Christians, we're part of a story where our ancestors are Jews and Africans and women who were prostitutes and, you know, and that might reframe the way our identity today, perhaps.
Yes.
I think there's something we should be attentive to. If you look at verse 32, and what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets. What interests me here is that certainly with Samson and with Jephthah, there are women in their lives who are victims of their faith.
Yeah.
And I think we need to see that faith can sometimes... so we look at the one who may be offered, as they are here, as exemplars of faith, but there's a cost to someone else. Jephthah's daughter is sacrificed because of her father's faith. The woman that Samson connects with are sacrificed because of Samson's faith. So faith can be not always a positive thing. And I think verse 32, it would be a useful way to reflect on how faith is understood in each of these different characters and the cost of that faith to other parts of their family
and community. Also, and also that you can be an exemplar of faith, in, but that does not mean you're perfect, right? These people also did some terrible things. And so being a person of faith does not mean you don't need to do the examination we've been talking about. The other thing that struck me in this, I mean, we get in verses 33 through just 38, I mean, a long list of, including quite strange things like being cut in two, the cost of faith, but some of them are very active. You know, these are people who, you know, put foreign armies out and quenched fires and, you know, suffered martyrdom, you know, through some sort of spiritual strength and all of that. There's a sense here that faith is an active thing.
It is.
It's not personal piety. It's not going to church on Sunday and praying really hard but never doing anything else. So I think, again, here we have a connection even back to our Isaiah and Psalm readings, you know, that this faith is costly and demanding, and if we're not embodying it in our action in the world, it does not fit this kind of narrative of faith that we get here. Anything else to add? Any last? Or the only other thing I'd say about this passage is we have this arena or this kind of Olympic imagery going on. Mm-hmm. It's about racing. We've got so this is almost like faith as a marathon, not a sprint, is probably what I would preach this week. It requires training.
Yes.
It requires endurance. It requires a support team. You know, you could play with that metaphor a little bit, but there's conflict and contest in it.
Right.
So therefore, in conclusion,
yes,
living a life of faith is not an easy task.
No.
It comes with a lot of challenge, a lot of risk, openness to being killed, as, yeah. as some of these exemplars have mm-hmm. shown us. Mm-hmm. So faith is it's not easy. Maybe that's the reason why we are losing so many, but I don't know.
No, right. It's costly.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But
it
also is. Wonderful. We wouldn't do anything else.
I mean, we wouldn't.
Yeah, I know.
And the passage ends with Jesus.
Yeah.
So Jesus is in some way connected to this trajectory
yes.
of faith and comes to represent this messy, strange, remarkable line of commitment.
People. Yep.
And so I think ending with Jesus I think is significant for us as Christians. But remembering that he stands in this kind of this trajectory.
Yeah. Complex trajectory.
Yeah, very complex, yep. yes.
Thank you, Gerald, so much for being with us. It's Thank been you. Wonderful Thank to you. Have you join
Thank
us.
You. Thank you.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.